Say What? Say What radio show. With no agenda. It's always a surprise. But if we're not having fun, we're doing something wrong.
Welcome to the Say What special presentation of Woo Reality that will eventually be made into a book. My name is Nancy Hopkins, and the date of this recording is April 10th, 2026. So in the last episode, chapter 14, I ended it with talking about the remote view I did in the Shungite field concerning what I consider the Blue Star Kachina. When I went back and, you know, stopped the recording and went back in time to see where it came from, I saw what I said was the face of God. Now, did I think I saw the face of God? No, I thought I saw a symbol of the face of God, so that I would understand that Shungite is incredibly magical and that it's there because of a gift from whatever God source is out there. This presentation, chapter 15, I want to give you the reasons why I could make that determination without hesitation. And to be honest with you, it really started before virtually any of the woo-woo things I explained to you over these last 14 chapters. I think I must have been, I know I was not in college, and so it was probably my senior year in high school. I belonged to the Catholic Church, St. Rock's in Oxford, Massachusetts. And it was a winter day. It was very cold outside. And I got there and there was no place to sit. So I was standing in the aisle. And thank God that the wall of the church was right there, because this, you know, the ceremony's going on and stuff. And I remember thinking, God, I'm hot, because we all had the coats on, even though the heat in the church was pretty excessive. So I remember thinking, okay, I'm hot. But then the next thing that happened is I saw nothing. The church disappeared. Everything disappeared. There was no light, no sound, no earth, no third dimensional reality. Nothing was there. And I was stunned. I said, where am I? And I hear the word nowhere. Now, it didn't last very long, but when I finally started getting back into third dimensional reality, I realized I had just seen something absolutely profound. Now, some people would say, well, you overheated and you know, you blacked out. Maybe heat exhaustion was coming on, because heat exhaustion does have similar effects in that you go black. Everything you see, it goes black. And I know that because a few years before this, my family was down at the ocean, and we were playing in the water, and the water was very cold. And then Mom starts yelling to us to come up out of the water, and so we're going up to the water. And I remember, you know, walking towards the family, and my father wanted to take a picture. So we get there, and I'm standing where they wanted me to stand, And all of a sudden, everything went black. I felt like I was standing up, right? But I also realized simultaneously that I was falling. And I mean, I would thank God there was sand because it wasn't like I was falling to my knees and then down. No, I just, just from the side, just dropped into the sand. Now, it's kind of funny to me because my mom is an RN. And if you'd seen one of your kids sort of pass out on the beach, you'd think she would have had some kind of a reaction to it. Well, she didn't have a reaction to it. And my father was absolutely pissed off at me because I guess he had taken the picture as I was falling. I don't know. I never saw the picture. But he was yelling at me, and she was just standing there. And I'm in the dirt. I'm kind of woozy, but I was no longer in the state of complete blackness. So I know what it is to basically have something from heat because it was coming out of the cold water and hitting the sun, and it was very hot. I think that's what happened. So I know what that feels like. And this was not the same thing. I saw the blackness, but I didn't feel like I was falling over or anything. I was leaning against the wall, which, could have prevented that. But you just know that you've just been gifted some kind of a profound insight into reality. I cannot tell you how many times I've remembered that profound gift. And as I went through my life and I had the ET, the flying saucer experiences, and oh yeah, one time I saw a ghost, but I was in the dorm room and all of a sudden this human figure sort of, fuzzy human fi figure started materializing me in front of me, and I'm just like stunned. It's like, what's this about? But it was just that kind of a very short-lived thing. So all of the experiences I've had, except for the one when I was 8 years old and was running in the body of a Native American, they were more of the programming. And yes, it's programming. I was being programmed to accept a different reality than had been presented to me as a child. We talked about this concept that there is a filter in the brain that when whatever the brain is taking in doesn't fit the reality that it knows, it begins to filter out the information. This is why when I'd see these ETs with all these other people, nobody would talk about it because their brain is essentially, erased that as it was happening. It never took the information in, didn't know what to do with it. So for people like me, you have to kind of like turn off that filter so that it's not just what you have been taught to believe is reality, but that you can grasp real reality. So all these events, in my opinion, all these events that were happening were essentially my brain being, let's say, programmed to accept a reality that is different than the one everybody thought it was. So, with the filter being displaced, let's say, so that it didn't completely take out experiences, I was able to experience different versions of reality. I've told you all the stories, that happened while I was in college and stuff. And after that, a number of them. But I need to tell you another aspect of what this programming is. I think I was sent here. There's a story that before you come to Earth, again, in, what new body, that you actually have as a soul decisions to make. Well, what kind of parents, and it's dictated by your soul's own evolvement and what you need to know to take the next step in your evolution as a human being. In my case, I was getting all this woo-woo stuff, but I was also in college. And in college, at that time in the 60s, and I think it was to a great deal associated with the Kennedy assassination, because I think my generation had confronted the fact that reality as we had been taught it was not the reality that was. And I firmly believe that a child remains a child in the way that they think until there's a question that they ask adults, and adults can't answer it. At that moment, I think your brain begins to think in terms of the same way an adult does. It's not just the programming that you got from your schools and your family and your church. This goes into a different aspect of existing in reality as it is, not as we were taught it was. So my generation, the 60s generation, began searching in ways that I don't think my parents did to find out, well, what is really real? And yes, there was a, at the same time, there was, let's say, an evolution in the drug culture. Now, I was 19, it was a freshman year in college, before I ever even knew about marijuana. And the guy I was dating at the time, I'd come home from college, and he, hey, let's smoke some grass. I didn't know what grass was. But, he lights up this joint. And so I took a hit, and I don't know how many hits I took. But all of a sudden, I was like, oh my God. I was not prepared for what was happening to me. And I really got scared. And I told the boyfriend to take me to his best friend. Because to be honest with you, I trusted his best friend more than I trusted him. And his best friend explained to me what the grass was doing to me, and it would go away and, just kind of relax and see what it's all about, which I did. That was when I was 19. So there was a lot of, yes, I knew about hallucinogenics and basically just you hear about them. But I had no desire to try something like that. I mean, it was just like, oh, okay. But then by the time I got to be, I think it was, I think I'm pretty sure it was my senior year. I came home. I was living in a house with a lot of other people, private. We were off campus just by a little bit. And I came home with a friend of mine. We'd been going to the same class, and we came home. And we find out that all of the people that are living in the house and their boyfriends were, all I can say is, higher than a kite. I had never seen anything like it in my life. These people were like blissful, joyful. Just, it's so hard to explain it because it was like all of a sudden this is a reality and I'm watching it from the outside, you know, of people in a totally different realm of existence that I had no idea even existed. Now, yes, I was semi-prepared because I'd gone through the ET stuff and, you know, had a had some of the filter turned down. But myself and the girl that were not taking whatever they were taking, well, they told us it was MDA. Now, if they had said it was LSD, I probably would have had a totally different reaction because even though I didn't know what it was, there was a lot of scary stories about it. People jumping out of windows and weird stuff. But this was MDA and it was known as the love drug. Well, it was just kind of an amazing experience to see the changes in people that I knew very well who were in a totally different world than normal. So this friend of mine, Abby, one day she comes up to me and she says, "Look it, I got some of that MDA. Do you want to try it?" And I was like, "Yeah," because I wanted to experience the blissfulness, the joy, the unbelievable happiness that I had seen my friends experience. So we go to the middle of the campus where there was a pond, and the pond wasn't very big, but it had, I don't know, maybe four or five white swans that always were there. It was a lovely, lovely place. And around it, there were shrubs, flowers, that type of thing. So we sit down on the side of the pond in the shrubs, basically, and we swallow this MDA. And we're sitting there and we're talking to each other, and I'm going like, "I don't feel anything, do you?" And she's going like, "No, I don't, I no, I'm not feeling anything." And then boom. All of a sudden, everything changed. From a visual standpoint, everything lost its sharpness. I won't say it get blurry or anything, but it was sharp, but the angles, the there were no angles. It was the weirdest visual thing I'd ever experienced. Now, I can't say that I remember anything particular except that visual effect. I didn't feel joyful or blissful. I mean, maybe I did, but I wasn't like, I didn't. If I was experiencing it, I wasn't recording it. I was just going through it. So that was the, let's say, the first introduction to hallucinogenics, except for one other thing, which allowed me to be able to take the MDA, basically. Okay, so I was 19 when I started smoking grass, but then through the college years, everybody was smoking grass. And then one day, and this was probably my sophomore year, one day, this friend had, she said, "I got some really good marijuana. It's coated with peyote." And peyote is a cactus that somehow or another they get a hallucinogenic off of. I don't know how it's done. But supposedly this grass was co coated with peyote. So we smoked this, and what an amazing experience it was. Yes, it was hallucinatory. You had all sorts of different things happening to you visually, and there was like five of us. So we just go out, it was nighttime, and we go out and we start walking through the campus. And we were having so much fun. It was just fun. We ended up doing, the Wizard of Oz. We all had our arms locked in and we were doing singing the Wizard of Oz and, that type of thing. I remember it being very, very nice. It was just a good feeling type of thing. As far as what kind of information I was taking in, the only thing that really impressed me was that we walked all through the campus and we were coming back and we were walking by an area where it was like a field and they were playing soccer. No, I'm sorry, they were playing frisbee. And when I would look at these people playing frisbee, it was all in slow motion. They were moving in slow motion. The frisbee was like going very, very slow and getting to, it was an amazing visual experience. But other than that, I don't remember anything except it was a nice thing. So it set me up to be able to be open to hallucinogenics. So the MDA thing, okay, that happened. And I mean, I didn't go out and say, "Oh, I want more of that," or anything. No, I didn't have any of that kind of a feeling. But then when I was in my senior year, I went to one of the other colleges in the area just with a friend to visit their friend. And while I was there, they had LSD. So I take the LSD and have another experience that was just a feel-good experience. And at one point, we were outside. We'd started in the dorm. I was outside with these other people that had taken it. And on the other, it was another pond, and there was all these people on the other side of the pond. And I knew what they were thinking. I had like an upgrade in telepathy. No, I was familiar with telepathy because we'd done that weird stuff when I was in my freshman year about, practicing it and getting pretty damn good at it. But it was like everybody I could I was they were too far away to hear, and yet I knew I could hear. I could in my mind I couldn't, I mean in my mind I was hearing what they were saying. And again, that was about it. That's what I remember from it. So I was not somebody that was into LSD or hallucinogenics at all. It was somebody that was had experience with them. So flash forward into I had come down to Miami to visit a friend of mine. Well, this is kind of a weird story. I was teaching at the high school that, well, it wasn't the same building, but it was the high school that I had gone through, and I was substitute teaching. The other person who was a substitute teacher was somebody that was my age. She had graduated from the University of Miami. And even though I knew her, I was not didn't hang out with her when I was in high school. But in this situation, yeah, we hung out. We became very good friends. Well, she goes through winter and she says, "That's it, I'm going back to Florida." She couldn't take the cold. So she was back in Miami when I went down there. I got a job. I mean, when I realized that, whoa, you don't have to have winter if you live in Florida, I decided, no, I just went down there for, it was kind of an open thing. again hard. And now this is another one of those manipulating you to do something. I had stopped at the sandwich shop and was buying sandwich when I realized that one of the people in the booth with a couple of kids was somebody I'd gone to high school with. So I went over and I said, "Hey, how are you doing?" And, "Oh, sit down." And, so I sit down with them. And she said that she was married and had was living in Florida, but had come up, to Massachusetts to visit with her kids, and that she was going to go back to Florida. And she was looking for somebody to drive down there with her. Well, at that particular time, I had quit my job. And at the time, it was working in a nursing home. And the reason I had taken the job working in the nursing home was because it was something I didn't think I could do. I had had a lot of other jobs, but this job, now remember, this is probably, I think I've been out of college for a year. And the concept of being in a nursing home was kind of frightening to me because you're going into another world, a world of people at the end of their lives. And I worked the night shift. I learned more in the 10 months that I worked there than I have ever learned in a similar time frame. I learned about life in ways that you wouldn't have gotten any other way. And one of the things that I took away was this one woman that I really had a good friendship with. And she said, "You know, I've never regretted anything I did in life, but I've regretted the things I did not do." And that was the teaching that I got from that particular nursing home. Well, I quit the job because the company that the company had been taken over by another company, and the entire feel of the nursing home changed. We didn't have supplies like we should, and I actually reported them. It was so bad that I reported them to the state, and the state, I had a meeting with some representative, and they said, "We're going to do a surprise inspection." So I go back to the nursing home, and all of a sudden, all of the supplies that we didn't have were there. And we were cleaning up and doing stuff that, and yeah, we're going to have an inspection. Well, at that point in the game, I realized that I could not stay there and watch the patients that I had learned to, well, they had taught me so much and really cared for. I couldn't stay there because I couldn't help them. And this was not a good scene anymore. So I quit the job. And just after I quit the job, I meet this girl in the sandwich place who needs to have somebody drive with them down to Florida. Well, I didn't have anything else to do, and Gail was back in Miami. So I said, I called her up and I said, "I've got I can get down to Florida. Can I come visit you?" "Oh, yeah." So that's what happened. And the whole way down, it was November. And all the way down, it kept getting warmer and warmer and warmer. We finally get to the north part of Florida in Jacksonville, where this woman lived. And I got on a bus. And I went from the top part of Florida down to the bottom part of Florida. And it took me longer on that bus than it did to drive all the way from Massachusetts to Florida. So I really loved it. I mean, it was like I didn't have to worry about winter and snow, and the year before it had been a terrible winter. And she was very conducive to me moving in with her. She had an apartment. Yeah, why don't you just stay down here? And I found a job right away. It was a private club, like they served sandwiches and stuff, but it was basically a bar, but it was a private bar. And you had to be a member to get in and all this. It was top of the line. So I was on the lunch. I had the lunch time. That's when I was working. But then after that, I would also do the nighttime. And one day, this guy comes in, and to be honest with you, he was very, very charming. So I end up going out on a date with him, and he said to me, do you do LSD? And I said, well, I've done it, but I don't do it. And he said, well, I've got some, so let's just do this. So we do the LSD, and again, nothing big time happened. It was just a lovely time. He was an amazing a partner, let's put it that way. And at the time in the private club, there was a band, a private band that was working there, and I became very, very friendly with them. And so when this guy had the LSD, I said something to well, it was him and his wife and another and a drummer. There was only three of them. And I said something to them, and Alan said, oh, I'd love to do some LSD. He'd done it before. And I said, well, I think he's got some more. Let me ask him. And yeah, I got some LSD. And I go over to Carol and Alan's place, and Carol didn't want any of it. And Alan and I do the LSD. And again, nothing, it was a fun time, but nothing that was notable. Well, a little bit after that, actually, it was probably a few months. Carol says to me, do you have any more of that LSD? For some reason, she wanted to do the LSD. And I said, no, but I know somebody that might. And the somebody that might was this guy by the name of Peter. Well, Pete. Now, one night, the doorman had said to me, I've got a friend coming over. And because he had to be on the door, he said, would you kind of like, take care of my friend? And I said, yeah, sure. And his name was Pete. And I said to him, well, what's Pete's last name? He said, I don't know. None of us know. We just call him Pete the Sailor because he's some kind of a merchant sailor, and he comes in and out, and we see him, and then he goes away for months on time. And, so anyway, the weird thing is that I didn't realize this until, I don't know, 20, 30 years later, is that Pete the Sailor looked identical to my friend Peter, who was blonde. Pete the Sailor had really, really beautiful black hair. But the same body, I mean, basically the same guy, but the hair was different. So anyway, I'm with Pete, and he was very, very odd. Let me put it to you that way. I enjoyed him. I spent a lot of time with him. We never had sex. He had a lot of friends. We'd go out and we'd do different things in different places, and he always seemed to have drugs, but he never did drugs. But he always knew where to get them, blah, blah, blah. And I was with him for a couple of weeks. So in this couple of weeks time frame, Carol asks for the LSD. So I said to Pete, I said, "Can you get me LSD?" And he looked at me kind of odd. And he said, "I think so." So the next day, I had to work, I had worked the night shift. And so, I mean, I got home probably 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'd never get up until after 11. There's somebody at the door, and normally I don't even think I would have heard it, but I did. And I got up and I opened the door, and here's Pete. And he said, "I think this is what you're looking for." And he handed me this, like a sandwich bag. And it was full of all these little pink tablets. I mean, like 100 pink tablets. And I was groggy because he woke me up and I should still be sleeping. And he's, I think this is what you're looking for. And he hands it to me. He turns around. He never even came in the apartment. Turns around and leaves. I never saw him again. But what he had given me was 100 hits of supposed LSD. But this wasn't like anything I had ever come across. They were tiny pills, pink, and the size of like nitroglycerin pills. I mean, very, very small. That year was the most amazing year of my life because didn't have to take a whole pill. We discovered that you could actually just take a chip of it, you know, just four people easily could trip on one of these tiny little pills. And I had some amazing LSD, well, because to be honest with you, for the next year, I was on LSD. This stuff, I don't think it was LSD. I think it was something totally magical. It was one amazing experience after another, to the point that myself and the band started up a restaurant club thing that rivaled anything in Miami. It was just extraordinary experience. But that extraordinary experience, and there was telepathy, everything you can imagine. I mean, like I was just in a totally different reality for a year. To give you one example of what would happen on it, one day I wake up and I had gotten to the point that I was chipping it. Remember, 365 days, I got 100 of these pills. I did 365 days, okay? And I would chip it before I fell asleep so that when I woke up in the morning, I was back in the wonderful reality, whatever these pills were bringing me to. It was like, whoa, this is cool. So I wake up and I'm tripping. And the room I had was like a concrete block room that was just white. And I open my eyes and I'm staring at this wall. And all of a sudden, the wall opens up like a portal. And I am sucked out of my body. I mean, I didn't know remote viewing and all this stuff, but I was really sucked right out of my body. And I'm traveling through this. It was like a tunnel thing. And as this is happening, I feel somebody else going in the other direction. And all of a sudden, I stop and I'm in this body of a man. And I'm standing in a room that has, it was all white. And there were, and I was looking out towards the ocean. It was like there was a balcony, and the ocean was there. And I'm standing there, and I'm looking at the ocean, And all of a sudden the water parts, and it way out in the distance, but it kept coming closer and closer to the shoreline. And then just before that, I turned to my left and there was this woman there. And I recognized the woman. It was my friend from the band Carol. And I'm standing and I got a real read on the guy I was in. And he was not a nice being, to be honest with you. But all of a sudden, there is this crack above my head. I look up and this huge pillar had broken and the ceiling was coming down. And I looked back at her, and it was like I had this momentary OF, And I realized that who I thought I was and what I thought was wrong. And as soon as this kind of like realization came over me, whoosh, I was taken back through the tunnel, felt the other guy, because his inner soul, I guess, was taken out and went to Miami, Florida in the future. And I feel him go through me as I'm going the other direction. And that when I come to, let's say, I'm still in bed and I've just had an extraordinary experience, but I was on the LSD and I had had things like this occurring continually for a year. But that was Atlantis. And after that experience, in the years, decades since, I realized that I have an understanding of Atlantis that most people wouldn't, because I actually experienced the life that lived there at the time of its destruction. But this is the type of thing that happened for a year. I mean, just one miracle thing after the other. It was a lot of fun. But it ended because before I'd even gotten to that point, I had been in Massachusetts. I think I told you about it. got meeting some friend up. I ended up talking to different enlistment people, and the Army had an incredible enlistment process. And so I had gone through in, the testing and everything. And I was told that it would take 2 years for them to get, have an opening that I could go in the Army. Well, it turned out to be more like just over a year. So I had to leave that where I was and go into the Army. But I was almost out of LSD anyway. I had three pills left. So I fly on this plane and fly into the Army. That's all I can tell you. But so I had some magical experiences that had opened me up into a totally different perspective on reality. Now, out of all the experiences I had on the LSD, it was the first time I took it with Carol and Alan. They had two kids, and it was after work. We started this thing at 2 o'clock in the morning. And they go to bed. And I have no idea. I did not know at the time that you didn't need one pill. You could chip it. And I decided to take another LSD. This was early morning. The sun was not up. So I dropped the pill. And the next thing I know, I'm feeling like there that I'm in a small room. The room I was in, the bedroom, which was made to look like a spaceship, to be honest with you. It had a sunken bed, and it was a great party room. They didn't actually sleep in there, but it was like this big bed, and it had sides up on the top. It was like a sunken bed. It was an amazing room to trip in. And I felt like the walls had all come in, and I was very confined. And I'm putting my hands out, and I'm testing this, and yes, I seem to be trapped in some room. And so I understand you're not rationally thinking through these; you're kind of just reacting. And so I pushed through this one wall, and boom, I'm in another one, but it was slightly different. And I do it again, and I do it about four times. And the fourth time, I can't get out of the room. But then I notice the ceiling. And, well, ceiling, I don't know what. I looked up, and there's a trap door. So I sort of said, well, let's go through the trap door. And the next thing I know, I'm standing in a outside, beautiful sunlight, in a place that was just gold instead of green, and it was all golden yellows. It was like a how would you say? It was like a field, and it was went on for a long time, but everything was gold. And I'm looking around, and I'm going, "Where the hell am I?" And then I notice there's a picket fence, but only the gate. Only the gate to the picket fences. There is a picket fence gate. And I'm drawn towards the gate. And as I got closer to the gate, I realized that there was somebody on the other side. This guy was had white hair. He was in a white robe. He was just had an amazing smile, and he opened the gate. So I walked through the gate, and suddenly in front of me, there's bleachers. Nothing else, just bleachers. But the bleachers were full of people, men and women, that looked similar to him. Basically, white haired and in white robes, and they're all sitting there. And all of a sudden, there's this chair, and this guide, I'll call him the guide, he points to the chair, and I go over and I sit down. And he says to me, "Ask any question you have, and we will answer it." So I start asking questions. I don't remember what I asked, I don't remember what the answers were, but it was like everything. I had a question about regarding reality was being answered. And I don't know how long, I don't know how many questions. It was just all of a sudden I didn't have any more questions. And so he says, "Okay, good." You know, and he motions me to get up out of the chair. I get up out of the chair. I follow him into the gate. And just before we got to the gate, he said to me, "When you go through the trap door again," he said, "you'll always remember that you were here, but you're not going to remember the answers." And I thought, well, that's a damn bad thing. What's all this about? He said, "Until you learn them, until in the 3D world." Next thing I know, I go back down through the trap door. I'm back in the bedroom. Okay. Now, many years later, I was introduced to the concept of the land of the golden light. In metaphysics, it was some place that was known. People went there. There was never any real details about it, just that it existed. And that's where the White Brotherhood could be contacted. I didn't know anything about the White Brotherhood. But apparently I had been able to ask the White Brotherhood any question in that I had, but I couldn't remember the answers. Over the years, I can't say that I'd learn something and say, oh, the White Brotherhood told me that. It just would be that the answer felt very real, and I didn't tend to question it. And I basically, that's what my whole life has been since then, is that I know that I was taught by the White Brotherhood about all sorts of things, and that I had been blessed with LSD that was not LSD. It was some kind of a mind-altering drug. Yes, absolutely. But it was not LSD. It wasn't manufactured on this earth. It came from someplace else. So that experience, that whole LSD year of it, and the White Brotherhood, I mean, that was the first introduction I had to this LSD. That was one of the reasons that, and I knew the connection. I said, "Boof, I don't know what's happening to my life, but I definitely have got a mission here, and I am essentially special because I don't know too many people that were doing this, but that I had a mission, and I became really, really dedicated to doing whatever it was I was sent here to do. Let me just put it that way." But then I go into the military, and you know, basically that story. During the military times, I don't remember ever having a woo-woo event. I was so wrapped up in what was happening in the 3D world, I learned a tremendous amount of information about what is 3D real. And then I ended up in the Wilder Yard. Once I got to the Wilder Yard, and this was like 1986 when I bought the property. In that first time frame where I was on the same timeline that I had been on, I had some really very interesting experiences that fall into the realm of what I would define maybe as spiritual. Okay. I could say metaphysics, but it was even more than metaphysics because metaphysics is like, there's a science behind it, enterology. But this was beyond even that. To give you an example, I was out in the Merkabah by myself, and I was cleaning it up. I was, just cleaning it up and stuff. And we had like a, not so much an altar, but this structure that had all sorts of gemstones on it. And I was cleaning up all those things, and all of a sudden, I could smell horse. And I'm going like, why would I be smelling a horse? And then I hear like a hoof in the soil. I don't know if you can hear that, but bump, bump, bump. And so I turned around, and standing 6 feet away, probably closer, there was this huge brown chestnut horse. It was just big and the most beautiful horse I've ever seen. And on top of the horse, the rider, I knew it was a human or human form, but it was so bright, the light and everything else, that I really couldn't tell you what the features were. And my response in shock was, "Who are you?" And the horse rider said, "I'm Gabriel." And I did at that moment the one thing that a metaphysician should never do. I said, I don't believe this. And poof, the horse, Gabriel, gone. I've never done that again. Even though I've been tempted to do it, I just, I know that, shoot, what would I have learned if I hadn't said that? So that falls into what I call a spiritual kind of thing. So then another time, and this is all, in the old timeline. So then another time I'm in the Merkabah and I'm lying down on the glass bricks that were covering the copper grid. And I'm just kind of meditating. And then all of a sudden I hear this kind of a commotion is the way I'd think of it. And I looked to my left. I'm still laying down. I'm not sitting up or anything. And I looked to my left and just to the side of a pole. Now the pole was holding up a circle. There was a whole series of poles and there was a circle all made in copper. And on top of that was a pyramid. Giza type, four-sided. When we were putting the circle in to begin with, myself, Peter, and Curtis were there doing this. The pole that I had when I went to push it in had virtually dropped. There was some kind of a void in the ground right where that was supposed to go. So the guys had to pull theirs out and we had to readjust it so that I was missing this void. And the pole had something to, stand in. So right there next to the pole, I see this gnome. That's the concept of a gnome that I grew up with, well, heard fairy stories and stuff, didn't think it was real. But it was a gnome, kind of a little pudgy kind of guy, small. I'm talking, I don't know that he was 2.5 feet. And he pops out of this, what I know is a void underneath. And I'm like, just watching it, I'm going, I'm not even kind of analyzing it. I've learned, just to observe and see what happens. And then all of a sudden, standing in front of me was Archangel Michael. I just knew it was. And the gnome dives back into the hole, and Michael dives in there with him. And I'm laying there on the glass and the copper thing, and I went, oh, well, I think I'll go with him. And so I go out of body and go into the tunnel system. Now, I was familiar with the tunnel system because we had had a group that would get together. And when there was a disaster someplace, like a Hurricane Hugo up in the Carolinas, we would transport ourselves through these tunnel systems that shamans understand. A lot of people that are, totally metaphysical understand that there is a tunnel system. And this isn't a, like a big cave or anything. This is tunnels. And you can travel through them and go any place you want. And we had done that. When we did the hurricane in the Carolinas, it was pretty awful. When we popped out of there and we're looking at the destruction and the emotional trauma that the people had gone through. It was pretty difficult because after we would do this, we would come back into the room and we would discuss what we saw, and we all saw the same thing. So then there was an earthquake in California, and we did the same thing. We went through the tunnels and we popped out, but this was a totally different thing. instead of the angst and emotional trauma that was there, there was none. And we came back and we talked about it. And this was an earthquake that had taken out a bridge and a bunch of people had been killed. And what we all agreed with was that the people that had died, it was their agreement to die on that day. And that we did not feel the emotional trauma that we had felt when we went to check out Hurricane Hugo. So I knew that the tunnel systems were there, and that's why I felt comfortable jumping in after them. And these two were like flying, through this tunnel system. And I'm having a hard time keeping up with them. And all of a sudden, I don't know where they are. But I keep going forward, and then all of a sudden, there's an opening in the cave, and I stop myself before I go out through that opening because I don't know what the opening is going to. And thank God I did. I don't know what would have happened because I was on like a mountain that overlooked this valley. Beautiful valley, not very big. And there were all these sparkling lights. I'm not talking, maybe there were thousands, but there was many hundreds of them. These sparkling lights that were just kind of like coming up from the ground and floating up. And I looked at it, I recorded it, but then my concern was I didn't know where these other two were. So then I said, where are they? And the next thing I know, I'm standing behind them, and this time it's not the cave, it's like a cavern. And they're both standing with their hands up towards the roof. And they're really, really meditating, and a lot of energy was coming out of them. So then I said, well, what's up there? And all of a sudden, I'm like seeing a table, a large table with all these people in it, sitting around it. And at one end was Bill Clinton. And I said, where am I? And I get the word Detroit. And I can see that everybody seemed to be in agreement about something except this one person. And all of a sudden, what Michael and the gnome were doing seemed to fill him with some light and knowledge. And they all agreed to whatever they were agreeing to. And the next thing I know, boom, I'm back in the Merkabah. Well, it turns out that where I saw what I saw, the valley type of thing, was in Corsico. They had the Bosnia-Corsico war and stuff. And that this Detroit meeting, which I looked it up, we didn't have internet at the time, but recently I looked it up. And yes, Bill Clinton was there with heads of all sorts of countries that were supposedly talking trade, but apparently it had to do with the war. But something was agreed to that ended that war. The next example of those type of experiences came when Gene Rockefeller, who I've mentioned throughout the show, throughout the, past chapters, she calls me up and she says, I'm going to send you some archangels, five of them. I said, what are you talking about? And this was something that was going on. I mean, I actually, by that time, we had internet stuff. And yeah, this was some phenomena that was happening at the time. Yeah, this friend of mine said they wanted to send me five angels. And yes, it's real. So now the next process is that they stay here. I don't remember how many days, but it was a few days with her. She was to send them to somebody else, and she decided to send them to me. And they would be there at 10 o'clock at night. And I had to have like a white candle. I had to have a white flower. I don't remember the other things that were required to kind of welcome these angels. I didn't believe it for a second. Even because even having the other experiences, this just sounded profoundly crazy. And but I trust Gene Rockefeller, so I'm going to prepare just in case. And so I do. And I was watching the clock, 10 p.m. Okay, all right, And at 10 p.m., I simply went to the door and opened it up. I think my knees almost buckled because what I saw when I opened up the door were five angelic beings. There was Michael, Gabriel, Raphael, Uriel, and Metatron. That experience with them showing up like that led to 5 days of just kind of crazy stuff. I mean, yes, I saw them. Yes, they were there. Yes, I interacted to a point, but I was kind of weirded out by the whole thing. And I had my own life to live. And I'm only going to give you a couple of examples. So I was working on a roof and I managed to cut my finger to the bone. It was gushing blood. And I'm screaming at the archangels, "Why did you let me do that?" And I get off of the roof. There's a blood trail all the way from the down the roof on the side of the building, all the way into the house. And I put my hand under the faucet, and my finger was. I'm going like, "Oh my God, I got to go to the hospital. This is, something that's really dangerous." And so I put my hand under the faucet, and I watched it heal in a matter of not a minute, less time than that. So I now know that, this is a real thing that's happening. Another example, and I had conversations with them and just enjoyed the crap out of them. I don't even know how to explain it. But another time, I had to go to the Home Depot, the lumber store. Because what I was doing was I was taking a metal shed and putting mesh on it that then I would apply, like stucco, which is kind of a concrete thing, to take the metal and make it into a stucco building, including the roof. That's how I was up on the roof. So I need to go and get more stucco. And I go to the store, Home Depot, and I know exactly where they have it because I bought a lot of it. And I go there, and instead of there being a pile of stucco that I could pick up and put on the wagon, this thing was like over my head. It was a pile of stucco bags, but over my head. There was no way that I could reach up there and take one of these 60-pound bags without hurting myself. And I'm like, "Oh my God, I gotta find somebody." And one of the archangels said, No, just put your hand on it." So I stretched out, touched the top of the pile onto a bag, and the damn thing levitated, and all I had to do was guide it and then put it on to the wagon. And I did this five times. When we get to the curb and I'm going to be putting it in the car, I actually had somebody do that because I thought if somebody sees me levitating this stuff, it's going to be a weird situation. So they put it in the car. Then I get home and I went, oh crap. And I said to myself, well, let's see if it works again. And sure enough, I could levitate each bag right out of the car and put it in the wheelbarrow. Now I swear all of this stuff was that I just told you is true. So after the 5 days or whatever it was, the archangels leave, but I sent them back to Jean. Okay. And then she sent them back to me. So the second time they got here, I said to them, look it. I said, why don't you just think of this as your second home? Anytime you want to come to Earth and just kind of do whatever, feel free to come in. I'm not going to pursue this exercise. And we've left it that way. And yes, if I need to talk to an archangel, I can talk to an archangel. I learned a lot about each one of them. Who's responsible for what and everything. One time, Metatron showed up in a tree that was next to the Merkabah. I'm not sure if I called for somebody or he just showed up, but I remember I'm like looking at this tree and I realized that Metatron is, kind of like inside the tree. And I said, why are you in a tree? Why do you look like a tree? Well, why not? I mean, I was getting answers like that, But I swear to God, what I just told you is absolutely the truth, as I know it. I mean, I can only tell you that while I was able to have all these really mystical, like, you'd think somebody was crazy to tell you these stories. I had a full-time job. I wasn't having any problem anyplace. I wasn't delusional and seeing things and talking, anything like that. It was simply experiences that were metaphysical in the highest degree, but they weren't interfering with my life. I was not walking around with people going, is this lady nuts? So I'm going to leave the broadcast here. And I'm not exactly sure where we're going to go next time. But I'm sure we'll have fun doing it. So I thank you for listening. I hope you found it entertaining and informative, and be safe.
Say what? Say what radio show? With no agenda. It's always a surprise. But if we're not having fun, we're doing something wrong.